The headlines. British officials put several armed Navy boats on standby to help protect the UK's fishing waters in case of a no-deal Brexit.
Justice for Casey!
Justice for Casey!
Anti-racism protesters rally in the U.S. city of Columbus, calling for justice in last week's fatal police shooting of a black man. And the U.S. Supreme Court rejects a lawsuit filed by the state of Texas seeking to overturn presidential vote results in four key states. Welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. Britain's Royal Navy boats are being prepared to protect the country's fishing waters in case the UK and the EU fail to reach a post-Brexit trade deal. The vessels are on standby to guard British waters from EU fishermen in case of no deal on fishing rights after the Brexit transition period ends on December the 31st. Navy officers will also be allowed to board foreign vessels and arrest fishermen. Fishing has been one of the sticking points in talks, which are fast approaching their end on Sunday, with both sides saying no agreement is likely. Meanwhile, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the talks over a post-Brexit trade deal with the EU are deadlocked.
The argument today is about the terms on which we trade with the European Union. And the issue at the moment is that they want talks in Brussels are stymied, deadlocked, because they want to keep us locked into a system by which every time they change their laws, we have to change our laws. And we don't think that's a brilliant idea.
Johnson said, however, the British companies will enjoy big opportunities in case of a no-deal Brexit. The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen also told bloc leaders that a no-deal is the most likely scenario. Meanwhile, the Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin said that his country still hopes a last-minute deal. Speaking after an EU meeting in Brussels, Martin said the Irish economy would be damaged in the event of a no-deal Brexit. Johnson and von der Leyen given negotiators until Sunday evening to break the current deadlock. The Turkish Foreign Ministry has rejected the conclusions of the December 10 European Union summit, calling them unlawful and biased. In a statement, the ministry condemned the EU Council's plan to impose sanctions on Turkey over its maritime disputes with Greece and Cyprus. The sanctions target a list of Turkish officials and entities for, quote, unilateral actions and provocations in the Eastern Mediterranean. Tensions escalated between Ankara and Athens in August after Turkey sent an exploration ship to the waters also claimed by Greece. Athens slammed the move as illegal and requested the EU to impose sanctions on Ankara. Americans have hit the streets in the state of Ohio to demand transparency in the investigation of the fatal police shooting of a black man.
Justice for Casey!
Justice for Casey!
Protesters chanted slogans against police racism as they marched toward the Ohio State House in the city of Columbus. 23-year-old Casey Christopher was killed last week after a sheriff's deputy shot him multiple times outside of his home. Authorities and the victim's family have offered conflicting stories about the event leading to his death. Anger mounts despite Columbus officials promising an unbiased investigation into his death. This is the latest in a series of police killing of African Americans in the U.S. The country has witnessed mass protests against racial injustice and police brutality in the past months. Political analyst Alexander Azadgan says police brutality is systematic and remains rampant in the U.S., no matter who is in the White House.
The approach of Mr. Biden, President-elect Biden, is quite different than Mr. Trump. He is more reconciliatory. He would play a comforting role like most U.S. presidents traditionally carried when there were incidents like this. But this is much bigger than the White House or who occupies the White House. We're talking about systematic racism. We're talking about shooting first and not really worrying about the investigation. Well, the shooting is actually taking place in front of the camera. And then we have the problem with the police union who whitewashes everything and somehow creates some kind of a barrier between real law being implemented to these police officers and at the very least for them to be fired. So this is much bigger than whether there's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. We're talking about something that's encompassing, systematic, we're talking about the fact that the system itself, the structure in this country, knows that the country is on the verge of a revolution, and that it does everything and anything to make sure this doesn't happen by setting examples of all these poor innocent people so they wouldn't rise.
The head of the Republican Party in the state of Texas has suggested forming a union after the country's apex court rejected a lawsuit seeking to overturn the presidential election results. In a statement, Alan West said the Supreme Court's order had established a precedent that allows states to violate the Constitution and not be held accountable. He said law-abiding states should form a union that will abide by the Constitution. This came after the top court tossed up the Texas lawsuit to overturn Joe Biden's victory in the states of Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The ruling is considered as a crushing setback for incumbent President Donald Trump's quest to undo his election loss to Biden. Trump's team has already suffered multiple court defeats in similar cases in other states. However, Trump still refuses to concede, continuing fraud claims.
In a historic first, 18 states, led by Texas, sued four states over the long-running controversy of mail-in ballots. It was by far the most serious challenge yet to the integrity of the recent U.S. presidential election. The crux of the lawsuit was not related to the widespread allegations of, so far unproven, criminal conspiracy to commit voter fraud, but a question of constitutional law. The lawsuit asserted that constitutional law was broken months ago when some state governors bypassed state legislatures via executive order to issue unprecedented numbers of mail-in ballots. However, just 3 days before the Electoral College votes to decide the president, the Supreme Court rejected the lawsuit in a huge win for the projected victory of challenger Joe Biden. Biden supporters voiced relief and exasperation that election challenges are continuing for so long.
The real issue is there's no merit to the case. Why are we doing this? How many court cases do they have to be satisfied? There's probably going to be 25% of this public that still will never believe that he won that. But he did, fair and square.
Trump supporters are likely to now criticize the Supreme Court for allegedly playing politics and for not agreeing to hear the case in public. The lawsuit had been joined by the incumbent Donald Trump, two-thirds of all Republicans in the House of Representatives, and polls consistently show that 80% of Republican voters still believe challenger Joe Biden's projected win was due to vote fraud.
I don't think people accepted the results of the last election, so I think just as a two-party country, you're always going to have people that oppose it no matter what, and that will continue to happen no matter who won the election.
What's certain is that this is not the last election-related dispute. The lawsuit indicates the depth of grassroots and elite support for more unprecedented legal battles in order to decide who is the rightful president in this ever more divided nation. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has moved forward with major arms sales to Morocco. The package is worth $1 billion and includes drones and precision-guided weapons. The White House has reportedly sent a notice to Congress about the potential deal. This would be among the first drone sales under the Trump administration. The move comes after Washington announced a U.S. brokered agreement for the normalization of ties between Morocco and Israel. Earlier this year, the U.S. offered F-35 jet fighters to the United Arab Emirates as part of a deal to establish diplomatic relations with Israel. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has authorized the emergency use of a COVID-19 vaccine jointly produced by American drug maker Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech. The approval will pave the way for millions to be vaccinated in the world's hardest-hit country. The coronavirus pandemic has killed nearly 300,000 Americans so far. The U.S. is seeking to inoculate 20 million people this month. Healthcare workers and elderly people in care facilities are at the front of the line to receive shots. The U.S. is now the sixth country to approve the vaccine, after Britain, Bahrain, Canada, Saudi Arabia, and Mexico. The government says it is buying 100 million more doses of a second vaccine produced by Moderna. The two-shot regimen could be approved as early as next week. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says that his government is taking all necessary measures for the production of a coronavirus vaccine domestically. Rouhani said the government is ready to fully assist science-based organizations doing researches on COVID vaccines. He added that Iran is willing to purchase a vaccine from abroad once it is approved by the country's health ministry. The Iranian president, however, called on citizens to abide by health protocols and avoid gatherings, especially during the upcoming ceremonial events. He stressed that asymptomatic patients and those having no clear signs of the virus would pose greater threat to the people. Rouhani also hailed Iranian experts and specialists for their help in dealing with the deadly disease inside the country. Iran has executed a man who was convicted of corruption on earth, a charge used in cases involving serious offenses like espionage or attempts to overthrow the government. Ruhollah Zam was sentenced to death by a court in June after several sessions. Zam faced charges of committing offenses against the country's internal and external security, spying for the French intelligence agencies, and insulting Islamic sanctities. He had also created an anti-Iran website, Ahmad News, which was found publishing misleading contents against the Islamic Republic. Authorities say his online work helped inspire deadly anti-government protests in 2017. Zam left for France in 2009 following the post-election unrest in Iran. He was arrested last year and enticed back to the country through a complicated intelligence trap.
Death penalty. This was the sentence handed down to Ruhollah Zam for administrating a news website that Iran's judiciary says disseminates misleading content against the Islamic Republic. Ahmad News came to prominence during Iran's nationwide protests in 2017, which were driven by economic grievances. The Iranian government says the news network was inciting, quote, armed uprising against the establishment, while spreading damaging information about government officials.
During the 2017 unrest in Iran, Ahmad News Telegram channel frequently shared the time schedule for protests across Iran and detailed how they went down. It also regularly published videos from the protest, and Ahmad News Terwat was a peaceful demand for economic reforms into violent protests which were associated with vandalism and looting.
Zam left Iran for France following the 2009 post-election unrests in Iran. The Iranian judiciary says he was under the instructions and protection of intelligence services of France, Israel, and the U.S. Zam faced charges of having committed offenses against Iran's internal and external security, spying for the French intelligence service, and desecrating Islamic sanctities.
Ruhollah Zam was actually a small piece of a large puzzle that sought to bring about a regime change in Iran. I believe he fell into a trap spread by the CIA, Mossad, and especially the French intelligence agency. He became part of the United States' so-called 2020 project that was aimed at toppling the Islamic Republic to a sophomore in a three-time mark of 1999, 2009, and finally 2019.
Zam was arrested in October 2019 by the intelligence organization of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC says Zam was detained after being enticed into the country as part of a complicated intelligence trap. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence 5 months after the Islamic Revolution Courthouse issued the verdict for corruption on earth, a term used to describe capital crimes within the Iranian judicial system.
Ruhollah Zam will be executed, and there will be no change in the court's ruling whatsoever. Meanwhile, Ahmad News is still up and running, something which gives some clues that Zam was just a pawn in a wider game, orchestrated from outside Iran's borders. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A series of rockets have hit the Afghan capital Kabul, killing at least one person and wounding another. According to the Interior Ministry, at least four rockets were fired from northern Kabul and landed in central and the eastern parts of the city. Two of the projectiles struck near the Kabul airport, and the other two hit a residential area. The ministry added the assault was the second such attack to rock the capital in less than a month. No group has claimed the attack so far, but the Afghan government has implicitly blamed the Taliban militant group for the assault. 5 years ago, the Nigerian army attacked supporters of top Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki in the northern city of Zaria, Kaduna State. Hundreds were killed, many more arrested, including the cleric and his wife. Despite a high court ruling, Zakzaki and his wife have remained in jail as part of a government crackdown ongoing since the Zaria killings.
A massacre in Nigeria. The target, supporters of the country's Islamic movement led by top cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. At least 300 were killed and hundreds more injured by the Nigerian army in the northern city of Zaria from December the 12th to the 14th, 2015. The army said Zakzaki's supporters had refused to clear a road for a military convoy to pass and accused them of attacking the convoy.
But witnesses told Human Rights Watch that the army attacked Zakzaki supporters at three locations, including a mosque, opening fire at them. Some said soldiers opened fire at the people coming out of the mosque without provocation. HRW released a report a week after the massacre, calling the Nigerian army attack unjustified.
The Nigerian military's version of events does not stack up. It is almost impossible to see how a roadblock by angry young men could justify the killings of hundreds of people. At best, it was a brutal overreaction, and at worst, it was a planned attack on the minority Shia group.
Another international rights group, Amnesty International, said the army tried to cover up its crimes in Zaria. Amnesty made the conclusion in its April 2015 report that contained evidence compiled through witness testimony and satellite images.
It is clear that the military not only used unlawful and excessive force against men, women, and children, unlawfully killing hundreds, but then made considerable efforts to try to cover up these crimes.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife were arrested during the Zaria attack. A year after the carnage, the Abuja High Court ordered their release. But the Nigerian government defied the order. It has kept Zakzaki and his wife in jail despite their worsening health conditions. The Zaria massacre was the beginning of the government crackdown against Zakzaki's supporters and his movement. Scores of the movement members have been killed during peaceful rallies on various occasions, calling for his release. On July 28, 2019, the government announced a ban on the Islamic movement in Nigeria, accusing it of engaging in terrorist activities. The move drew a strong reaction from Human Rights Watch.
Allegations of criminality do not present legitimate grounds to ban the activities of a religious group, including protests for justice and the release of their leader. The ban on the Shia movement may portend an even worse security force crackdown on the group, which could have dire human rights implications throughout Nigeria.
Rights groups have repeatedly demanded justice for those killed in Zaria, but the calls have fallen on deaf ears. No probe done, no one punished. The crackdown has continued on IMN supporters, a minority group active mostly in northern Nigeria.
And that is World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Mark Garnett, a politics professor at Lancaster University, suggested the United Kingdom will be worse off under any post-Brexit economic arrangement with the European Union. He does not believe the leavers who claim Britain will quickly recover and end up being stronger economically. Professor Mark Garnett warned, in their eyes, no deal might actually be better for the UK because it will supposedly maximise the country's ability to make its own economic decisions. This argument has little support among economists or the business community and seems even less convincing since the economy has suffered the additional shock of the coronavirus pandemic. We now present you an article written by Ekaterina Blinova, a freelance journalist who has been a Sputnik contributor since 2014. The piece is titled, No Deal Brexit, Why UK Claims It Is Not Scared by Worst Case Scenario. Please stay with us to hear more of Ekaterina Blinova's article. While the United Kingdom and the European Union have yet to reach an agreement, one might ask who is set to lose the most from the looming no-deal Brexit. Although some economic specialists expect dramatic disruptions for the British economy, others claim that the United Kingdom will reap some purported benefits from a no-deal outcome. Although on 7th of December, EU Chief Negotiator Michel Barnier told the European Parliament that 9th of December was a deadline to strike a deal with Britain. An EU-UK compromise is nowhere near. Following the Wednesday, 9th of December, crunch talks between European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the two set a new deadline, stressing that either a Brexit deal will be sealed by 13th of December or there will be no deal at all. Meanwhile, citing the negotiators, The Guardian reported very large gaps remain between the United Kingdom and the European Union despite 9 months of bumpy talks. The sides have yet to find common ground with regards to three pressing issues: the level playing field, fish, and governance. A no-deal Brexit is looming as time is running out for the participants of the talks. Theophanis Exarchopoulos, a senior lecturer in European politics at the University of Surrey, argues, it is extremely crucial for the United Kingdom to reach a deal with the European Union in order to be able to have a smooth transition into the new relationship between the UK and the European Union. Exarchopoulos added, an agreement guarantees the continuation of the flow of goods in and out of the UK. It ensures the non-disruption of the flow of people and makes travelling easier. The senior lecturer in European politics at the University of Surrey noted the possibility of the worst-case scenario has already prompted a transfer of jobs across the English Channel to France, to Germany, and to Netherlands. And many companies have moved operations to European centres rather than within the United Kingdom. He expected that a no-deal exit could hit British farmers, who would no longer receive subsidies from the European Union budget, as well as the fisheries and tourism industries, logistic chains, manufacturing and business exchanges. He said, non-agreement will definitely affect those companies with extra import duties, taxes and delays at the borders. The senior lecturer in European politics at the University of Surrey, Theophanis Exodactylos, added, I'm not sure that any sector will gain substantially. Overall, no deal is no better than some deal with the EU. Britain, at the end of the day, will have a relationship with the European Union by default, so it's best to have it on some terms, rather than World Trade Organization terms, which would exclude it widely from trading and engaging the European Union as a bloc. Mark Garnett, a politics professor at Lancaster University, suggested the United Kingdom will be worse off under any post-Brexit economic arrangement with the European Union. He does not believe the leavers who claim Britain will quickly recover and end up being stronger economically. Professor Mark Garnett warned, in their eyes, no deal might actually be better for the UK, because it will supposedly maximise the country's ability to make its own economic decisions. This argument has little support among economists or the business community, and seems even less convincing since the economy has suffered the additional shock of the coronavirus pandemic. Still, it does not appear that the British government is scared by the no-deal scenario, despite the grim prognosis. In October, Prime Minister Boris Johnson made it clear that he preferred no deal to a bad deal, claiming on the Andrew Marr show that the United Kingdom could prosper mightily under those circumstances. Addressing his party fellows a year ago, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson noted that he wishes to avoid, but is prepared for, a no deal withdrawal. Richard Wellings, acting research director at the British think tank the Institute of Economic Affairs, argues, while a no-deal Brexit would cause short-term disruption, particularly for manufacturers with complex supply chains, it could bring benefits in the long term. Richard Wellings claimed, it would give the United Kingdom the opportunity to free itself from the huge burden of the EU regulations, reducing costs for businesses and consumers. Freer trade with the rest of the world would mean lower prices for consumers who would no longer be forced to buy goods from overpriced European Union producers. UK manufacturers would also be freer to source their components from cheaper sources outside of the European Union. Richard Wellings, acting research director at the British think tank, the Institute of Economic Affairs, added, when it comes to the EU's agricultural and food processing sectors, they're likely to be hit hard too, as UK consumers will shift to lower cost supplies in the rest of the world. The think tank director noted, the bloc's car industry may also suffer as Britons will acquire better value products from emerging economies, claiming that given all of the above, The main losers from a no-deal divorce are likely to be EU producers that are currently shielded from global competition by protectionist tariffs, by quotas and by regulation. However, Richard Wellings said to capitalize on all these purported benefits, the British government must adopt policies of deregulation and trade liberalization. Meanwhile, negotiators of the European Union and the United Kingdom are continuing to chew over the provisions of a potential post-Brexit trade deal, as neither of the parties involved seems willing to quit the talks first. The Spectator's James Forsyth maintained neither Boris Johnson nor his European counterparts wants to become a target of the blame game, which will inevitably start if the negotiations collapse. At the same time, while the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson would still prefer to have a deal, he no longer needs one, unlike in October of 2019, when he led a minority government. James Forsyth wrote, "In parliamentary terms, he does not need a deal the way he did last year." Johnson, on Thursday, 10th of December, vowed to go the extra mile for a Brexit trade deal, but instructed his government to prepare for Britain to crash out of the European Union's single market at the end of this year. The gloom deepened over the drawn-out Brexit saga after Boris Johnson and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, over a combative dinner in Brussels, declared on Sunday, 13th of December, a deadline to decide whether to keep talking or to give up. Boris Johnson stressed he wanted his negotiators to keep going and will go the extra mile for a last-gasp deal, and said he was ready to travel again to Brussels as well as to Paris or Berlin to get one over the line. But speaking after a rare evening meeting of the cabinet, the Conservative leader claimed his ministers agreed very strongly with me that the deal on the table is really not at the moment right for the United Kingdom. The pound, meanwhile, has slumped on currency markets as traders adjust to the looming possibility that after 5 decades of integration between Britain and mainland Europe, cross-channel trade will be subject anew to tariffs and quotas in the new year. Britain left the European Union on 31st of January, but a standstill transition period under which it remains bound by the bloc's rules pending any new deal ends on the night of 31st of December. Without a post-Brexit deal, Britain's trade with its biggest market will in future operate on pared-down World Trade Organization WTO rules, or Australian terms, as Boris Johnson prefers to call them, for public consumption. Johnson said, "We've not stopped talking, we'll continue to negotiate, but looking at where we are, I do think it's vital that everyone now gets ready for that Australian option." He accused the European Union of shifting the goalposts in the past fortnight by reviving demands for equivalence, meaning Britain will be bound to follow future regulatory standards laid down by Brussels to prevent either side gaining a competitive edge. He said refusal would mean Britain facing punishment, sanctions, tariffs or whatever, adding, "The other big sticking point remained EU members' future access to Britain's rich fishing waters." He said, "After many years now of voting to leave the European Union, we wouldn't still have control of our waters, and that's no good." And so the Cabinet agreed very strongly with it that we're really not there yet at all. Britain's chief negotiator David Frost and his European Union counterpart Michel Barnier resumed talks in Brussels on Thursday, 10th of December, despite the mounting pessimism. With nerves frayed on both sides of the channel, Ursula von der Leyen's outline of a backup plan to protect road, air travel and fishing rights was seen as a no-deal warning shot. Even though talks were still taking place, He said there was no guarantee any agreement could be in place by January the 1st, given the tight time frame. Several EU member states, notably France, have pushed the European Commission and Michel Barnier to take a tougher line and publish the contingency plan to show Britain they're ready for a no deal. The European Commission, the bloc's executive, called the plan a set of targeted contingency measures, which would come to an end if a deal is found or after a fixed period. Basic air transport will continue for 6 months, provided Britain agrees to reciprocate, as will access for road haulage. The interim fisheries regulation would continue until the end of 2021, but it provides for continued reciprocal access by European Union and United Kingdom vessels to each other's waters. Boris Johnson's government, which raised hopes of a breakthrough earlier this week with a separate agreement governing trade in Northern Ireland, promised only to study the proposals whilst restating its demands for Brussels to respect UK sovereignty. Many businesses are aghast at still being forced to wait to learn what rules will operate in 3 weeks' time, and accuse the government of failing to plan properly. Congestion building at key seaports is being seen as a sign of things to come. On Wednesday, 9th of December, Japanese carmaker Honda suspended production at its Swindon plant, west of London, because of a shortage of components. James Sibley, head of international affairs at the Federation of Small Businesses, said, "I think there's going to be terrible disruption in January," he added. "That will continue to be the case after a transition period ends, whether that's with a free trade agreement or otherwise."
The debate.
Morocco and Israel have reached a U.S. brokered agreement on normalizing relations. Under the deal, Rabat will establish full diplomatic relations and resume official contacts with Tel Aviv. As part of the agreement, Donald Trump, who is due to leave office on January the 20th, agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the contested Western Sahara region. Reacting to the new development, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas issued a statement strongly condemning the Tel Aviv-Rabat agreement as a political sin. Also, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement condemned normalization deal, describing it as a betrayal of Jerusalem al-Quds. Morocco is now the fourth Arab country after the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan to agree to a normalization deal with the Israelis since August. To help us better understand how Palestinians feel about this deal, we're now joined by our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, who's with us from Gaza. Ashraf?
Yes, but the Palestinians are outraged by this new normalization agreement between the Israeli regime and Morocco. This follows normalization of ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and the Israeli regime. Hamas movement said the normalization, agreement is basically a political sin and only encourages the Israeli regime to violate the rights of Palestinians. Islamic Jihad movement described this agreement as treason and betrayal to Jerusalem al-Quds and the Palestinian cause, while Mujahideen movement said that such agreement will never give the Israeli regime legitimacy or security. And also on Friday night, the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza said that the normalization of ties between Morocco and the Israeli regime is a backstab and will never hide the, quote, the ugly face of the Israeli regime. Palestinians feel betrayed by the normalization of ties between Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf region and the Israeli regime. And now you have United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, and already Egypt and Jordan have had so-called peace deals with the Israeli regime before.
All right, thanks a lot, Ashraf. That was our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, joining us from Gaza. Also with us on tonight's debate, we have journalist and political analyst Mr. Elijah Magnier joining us from Caracas. Also, we have CEO of the Ramadan Foundation, Mr. Mohammed Shafiq, who's joining us from Manchester. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magni in Caracas. Sir, how do you view this deal, taking into account the timing of it, as Donald Trump is on his way out?
I think Donald Trump is trying not to leave to Joe Biden the possibility to collect the work of normalization between Israel and other Muslim countries. And it makes no sense, it is not in the interest of the U.S. to see normalization between Morocco and Israel in particular, because the Moroccan population are really not in favor of the Israelis. I've been to Morocco several times, and I see how people behave with the Israeli, what they think, and what is their real feeling toward the Palestinian cause. This is one of the rare times the king of Morocco accepts to make a step that is completely against the will of the population, and this is why it is indeed a political normalization. Israel is going to gain a few flights between Morocco and Israel, and the publicity for Netanyahu, who is really in need to boost his image because he's in deep trouble domestically by facing new elections. He has the manifestation daily under his house. He's struggling because Israel is facing the biggest economic crisis ever. And also, it is the normalization with these countries, who never pose a threat to Israel, is also commented by the Israeli media itself, saying it doesn't make a lot of sense, really, because these were not the enemy of Israel. So it's a kind of a show. However, this is different from the Emirati normalization, because the Emirati population find themselves quickly integrated with the Israelis. This is not going to happen with Morocco.
Mohammed Shafir, I'd like to get your thoughts on the agreement as well. As part of it, Donald Trump, who's due to leave office, as we mentioned earlier, on January the 20th, agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the contested Western Sahara region. How will this deal affect Western Sahara? We also know it's not legal nor internationally binding for the U.S. to make this kind of deal concerning an area that's halfway across the world.
Yeah, I think it's a really sad moment that you've got Arab countries that have made relationships with Israel even before a Palestinian state has been recognized and enshrined under international law. And for that to happen, there's got to be an end to the occupation by the Israelis of West Bank, of Gaza, of the Golan Heights, and, you know, illegal settlements that have been built successively over decades, increasing the presence of Israeli citizens in Palestinian territories. And I think it's a really sad moment that the Arab world, instead of continuing to stand in unity with the Palestinian people and their struggle for freedom, is letting their relationship with a right-wing xenophobe in the White House, in this term, Donald Trump, on his way out after a humiliating defeat in the presidential election, and trying to restore relationships between the Israelis and Arab countries. And I think what we have to now do is that civic society, as my colleague from Caracas has said, is that civic society, the ordinary man and woman on the streets in Arab countries and around the world, are standing with Palestine in solidarity against the occupation, against the daily bombardment we see from the Israelis in the West Bank and in Gaza, where I've been three times and seen for myself the carnage that people live under. So, you know, we may be downbeaten, we may be concerned, and we may be, disillusioned. But I think it requires us to refocus our energy and commitment to the Palestinian cause, because it's a cause worthwhile supporting. The world, as Nelson Mandela said, the world is not truly free until the Palestinians are free.
Elijah Magnier, Palestine's Islamic Jihad movement has condemned the agreement, describing it as a betrayal of Jerusalem al-Quds. In the past, the Islamic Jihad movement warned that recognizing the Israeli regime is a great threat for the region. Do you see it in that light as well?
I think Israel is a threat to the region. Like the Russian ambassador said yesterday, one of the Russian ambassadors, Israel is carrying out unlawful assassination, is aggressive towards its neighbors, has carried out hundreds of attacks against Syria, is preventing the right of return of the owner of the land in Palestine, is attacking Lebanon, has attacked Iraq, is attacking even in Yemen. So Israel is taking the initiative on what is called a prevention attack under this false and unlawful title, attacking other neighbor countries because of domestic issues or because of its own policy. And also it is showing that it is not worth of making peace with any country around the Middle East. And what we see, unfortunately, is the Arab states have given up on the Palestinian cause, at the exception of Iran, that is still holding it and holding tight to it. Of course, there is Kuwait that has not normalized yet, but it doesn't have a power to stand against the Americans and the Israelis, while Iran has. So the Palestinian cause, at the end of the day, it's a universal cause of the right of the people to survive and to have their independence and have back their land, regardless the sectarian, regardless the religion, regardless the geography. And this is unfortunately not happening because there is no more international law. That's finished. We see when the Americans are imposing sanctions to starve population, it is a clear violation of the international law, and they don't care about it. So at the United Nations, there is a saying law for all being equal. Well, they should change that and saying no law for everybody. There is no more law. That's why the normalization with the Israelis on behalf of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian will, who refuse such a normalization until they get back their territory, is a crime not only against the Palestinians, because it is not right to say the Palestinian cause belongs to the Palestinians, but because to the free world, it belongs to the free world. And that is a crime against the free world.
Mohammed Shafi, four Arab governments have now established ties with the Israelis. In your opinion, does this put the security of the region at risk?
Yeah, I think it does, to the extent that, as you see, the biggest obstacle to peace in the Middle East is resolving the conflict of Palestine. And I think that if that can be resolved, if Israel can stop its illegal settlements, stop its daily oppression of the Palestinian people, stop the siege in Gaza, as we've seen for so many years, then there is a chance for peace and there's a chance for normalization. But what you cannot do is start the process of normalization and claim that you then still support a two-state solution, as some of these Arab countries do. They're entitled to their own foreign policies. They're entitled to have their own relationships. But what they're not entitled to is trying to, show the world that somehow they're supporters of Palestine, and at this step, establishing relationships with the Israeli authorities is somehow supported by the masses of the people. It's not. And I think it's really imperative that we all raise our voices in solidarity with the Palestinian people and be very clear about that. You talked about, my colleague in Caracas talked about just Iran, being the obstacle to Israel and its wider agenda. Actually, I'll add a few countries to that. You look at Malaysia, you look at Pakistan, the Prime Minister Imran Khan has been very clear that he would never recognize Israel until there was a Palestinian state. So there are many players, including the Turks, who have been very forthright. Whilst they have diplomatic relations with the Israeli country, but they have a love-hate relationship, if you like. And President Erdogan is quite outspoken on those issues. But I think you're seeing that leadership now from beyond the Arab states, because Palestine is not dependent on the Arab states. Palestine is dependent on the voice across the world, and that's been articulated by Prime Minister of Pakistan so eloquently in the last few weeks in his comments on never recognizing Israel until there is a free Palestinian state.
Mr. Magnier, the resistance movement Hamas has said that the deal will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the rights of the Palestinian people. Are these normalization deals, in a way, giving a green light for the Israelis to continue their brutal day-to-day violation of the rights of the Palestinians?
With or without normalization, the Israelis continue their aggressive behavior toward their neighbors and other Middle Eastern states. They consider they pose a danger to Israel expansion and plans. Just let me add something here, that no U.S. president ever managed to stop the Israeli settlements. Only Iran is supporting the Palestinian cause by financial means, media, and transfer of experience. The other state my colleague has mentioned, which I really appreciate, they vocally support Palestinians, but the Palestinians, although the vocal support is very appreciated, but the Palestinians need more than that. They are starving, they are surrounded, and Qatar from time to time give them money only for them not to rebel against the Israelis. So yes, Israel will continue its aggression. Israel, only by a policy of deterrence like Hezbollah has imposed on Lebanon, that Israel will stop being aggressive against countries who rejected the U.S. hegemony and the Israeli ipso facto in the region, and that is Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, and Iran. And these are the countries on the front line against Israel expansion and to stop its belligerent act in the Middle East.
Sure. Mohammad Shafiq, in the wake of these normalization deals, all Palestinian factions have been adamant that they will continue on with their resistance. How do you see the aftermath of this deal? Will we see a more united Palestinian front in the face of these measures?
I think one of the consequences of why this is happening is because of that broken disunity under Mahmoud Abbas and the PLO, who continued to negotiate and work with the Israeli government whilst not receiving anything in return. So we see a massive increase in the number of illegal settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. We see the continued oppression of the Palestinian people. We see what the situation in Gaza, and how important it is, as I said, raising one's voice, contributing to helping the humanitarian care issues, but also being very clear that our support is dependent on the Palestinians unifying. And I think if there's anything coming out of this, I think it shows the Palestinian leadership, from Fatah, from Islamic Jihad, from all the various political organizations, that they have to unite under the umbrella of the Palestinian struggle to make sure that there is freedom for the Palestinian people, and because this is a just cause that requires leadership and support from around the world. And that's what people like myself, I'm a British Pakistani Muslim, very proud of my heritage, very proud that my Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has taken such a vocal step in speaking up in favor of the Palestinians and never recognizing Israel until the Palestinians have a state. But I'm also equally proud of the fact that I've been somebody who's been to Gaza in the last, I went in 2013-14, I went three times. So I've seen what life is like for the Palestinians, and their struggle is my struggle, and I'll continue to raise my voice wherever I can on any platform to support the struggle for the Palestinian cause.
Elijah Magnier, what about the insufficient international response, like the OIC, like the Arab League? The Arab League, as we know, failed to condemn the recent normalization deals. Do you think Arab governments are now turning a blind eye to the suffering of their Palestinian brethren?
No, I don't think so. I don't think the Arab are turning a blind eye on the suffering of the Palestinians. I think the Arabs are partners of the suffering of the Palestinians. By accepting to normalize with Israel, there is no more Arab League. There is no more any unification among Arab countries for one cause, the essential cause of Palestine. We saw how the Saudis and the Qatari relationship went to the floor. We saw how the Saudis behaved with other countries in the Middle East. And we saw the aggressive between from Saudi Arabia toward Lebanon and Syria for 9 years of war. Qatar also participated in that. These are members of the Arab League. Yes, what my colleague said, I fully agree with. The disunity among the Palestinians is the problem. By a unified front among the Palestinians, then the Arabs will have to move, but they not, because Mahmoud Abbas is always on the camp of the Americans, and recently in a couple of weeks, the last couple of weeks, he changed his mind without even informing the Palestinians that he is going back to his old relationship and coordination on the security and all other levels with the Israelis and the Americans. The Arab League doesn't exist anymore. There is no more Arab League since the war in Iraq, since the war in Syria, since the violation of the territory of the Palestinians and the normalization of all the country encouraged by Saudi Arabia. Morocco would never have gone to normalize with the Israelis without the pressure of Mohammed bin Salman. So the Emirati is the same, the Bahraini is the same, the Omani is the same, they all followed. Sudan is exactly the same. So no, there's no more Arab League, and there is no more Palestinian cause for this bunch of countries.
Mohamed Shafiq, do you agree with our other guest? He says that Arab governments are not only complacent now, but are complicit in the suffering of the Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, you can take Egypt, for example, that has the Rafah crossing. It's continued to close the crossing. Very little humanitarian aid has been let through those crossings. And so it's a contributing factor into the ongoing struggle for a Palestinian freedom. And I think my colleague is absolutely right that the Arab League and the Organization of Islamic Conference have become toothless. We have a maniac in the White House in his final few days trying to force, nudge, threaten other countries to recognize Israel. And America, having so-called independent foreign policy, is now in a position where it's doing the bidding for its ally Israel in the region. And that's a real concern, that if you continue to, as I said, occupy Palestinian lands, you have illegal settlements, you have Gaza under an open-air prison, and the world recognizes the injustice, but the people with the power to change it are refusing to do that. And so I think, yeah, it's absolutely right that you look at, look at the Kashmiri cause from my neck of the woods in Pakistan, and Kashmiri, a struggle very much similar to what is happening to the Palestinians. Very much similar. The OIC refused to acknowledge it. The OIC refused to discuss it. And I think this is the moment for the masses around the world that believe in individual freedom,
sure,
and from our Islamic faith, to stand up against injustice anywhere in the world. And that should be our mission. And that's why we should support the cause of Palestine.
Okay, Elijah Magnier, one last question for you, very briefly, if you may, about these normalization deals. Donald Trump said more countries will be joining in. He mentioned, quote unquote, some of the big ones. Who are you expecting to see now before Trump leaves office?
I think he probably is thinking about Indonesia. He's probably thinking about Saudi Arabia, that is waiting for more countries to join in, and he would very much like to impose on Saudi Arabia, because he has a very strong card to wave in front of Mohammed bin Salman